Hello everyone, my name is Jacob Minig. I am the host of the Behavioral Health Integration Podcast. Today we have a very special guest, Michael Stein. Michael was born in Encino, California. He is an actor and director known for the films Boogie Nights, Rituals and Resolutions, and La La Land. Throughout this episode, Michael will get into his upbringing, what he had to do to overcome his barriers, and the mindset he needed to become successful in show business and in life. It's an honor and pleasure having Michael on the show. And without further ado, let's get started.
Michael, thank you so much for being on my show, man. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure. You're right up my alley. I love it. Let's ask away. What do you want to know?
Well, man, I want to know, first off, so what was your upbringing like? I'm not going to lie, I dug up a little information. So growing up, did you have a learning disorder of some sort?
Yeah, so I was born premature. My mom, they say I wasn't an oops baby. I was a total oops baby. My sister was the ploy baby. And then I have two older brothers that are separated by 10 years and 14 years. My mom had a volatile relationship. So she always likes to joke around. She goes, well, my son wasn't planned. I try to run up and down the stairs and drink and smoke, but he survives. I was like, mom, you don't have to tell everybody a story. You can just tell if you want ranch or blue cheese, you know, and she would, you know, tell everybody this. So I grew up hearing that story. So I was born premature. I had ADHD. They didn't know what it was back then. They put me at UCLA for an all school, which was like this school for learning disabilities. I had health issues, kind of a weird stutter because my mom talked real fast. She was like Don Rickles, good looking lady, but she was like, her personality was like Don Rickles. So I try to keep up with them, and we had a crazy, fast talking, volatile family, and I'd be tripping over my words. So I was just an awkward kid, you know, when I was really young, you know, I was in the hospital for 2 weeks. I don't know why. And I had a lot of, you know, just trying to figure it all out, you know, and it was a big question mark without getting into details. And then I think things changed when I was like 10, 11 years old, when I saw the movie Rocky. And then that inspired me to say, look, here's a guy like me. He doesn't know how to, he's not smart. The people that didn't think I was smart, he's funny. That was one thing. I can make people laugh. That was my only success. And, you know, and he keeps on trying. I kept on trying, you know, and keeps on getting back out. That's like me, but he was physically fit and I was not. I was very weak and uncoordinated. So I said, I'm going to do what he did. So I made physical fitness my cause celeb. And then by the time I was 16, I was a physical fitness trainer and had success as in that, not like professionally, although I became, you know, I was making money in high school as a physical fitness trainer. So that opened my eyes up to, I'm like, wow, time plus effort can equal success. So, and then I, you know, went on to do stand-up comedy and all the other stuff we'll talk about.
So who were your clients, like other high school kids, or where did you get them?
There's people in the gym that saw me get results really well, you know, and some from other high schools in the area in the San Fernando Valley. They said, dude, I want to like, cause at first I was like ripped, you know, and cut, you know, like, and I was like, I wanted to be like Stallone and Rocky III, you know?
Yep.
And then I got into pumping iron and went from like 135 pounds ripped at just when I turned 17, I joined Gold's and went from like 135 to like nearly 180, you know, just bulked up. I didn't, it was like, you're on steroids. And I was like, and then that's why I never took them, because I was like, wow, my body reacted to this really well. I can't have bragging rights if I, you know, so I swore up and down. Like, no, it's just, you know, eating like crazy, working out 7 days a week, sometimes twice a day. I really appreciated the success because, you know, a kid that was, everything failed for me in the first, you know, 13, 14 years of my life, you know, and I found success. So yeah, I got just by people seeing the results and said, you know, so I have other people in high school, other, you know, people at the gym.
So despite your disadvantages of, I guess, your learning disability or whatnot, were you still good at school? Did you overcame that and actually did pretty well in school? Or did you kind of just barely get by?
I barely got by. Look, things don't happen overnight. You know, it's progression is slow, right? So like I started to do a little better, but it was also, I guess it's an ADHD thing. I talk about ADHD, which I found out I have as an adult.
Which I have it too as well too. So I feel you.
Yeah. And I didn't want to pay too much creed to it because I didn't want to give it, you know, so I still to this day say, Mike, use the third eye on this thing, you know, try to say it possibly could be a thing. There's no exact science to it. So, but they say one of the traits is, you know, like you've got your hyper-focus. So when I was hyper-focused, I zeroed in on like, you know, really putting massive effort, hyper-focused effort, and then reaching success with that. So when I wanted to do stand-up comedy, I was writing on a type, my material on a typewriter, you know, when I was, you know, 16, 17, and I was like, I'm going to build up this. It took me until I was 19 to finally do stand-up, but I would write my routines, you know, and do work like that. Or if I did well in a subject and it interests me, like history, you know, something that had a story to it that I, you know, so I would do well with those things, but I barely graduated high school and I I said, I want to do a business. And I had a high school tutor and she's like, you might want to just work with your hands because not everybody's meant to do what they want to do. I said, I want to be an actor, a comedian.
I hate that. I hate when people say that.
Yeah, she was said it lovingly too. It was heartbreaking my heart. She's like, look, I could see the love in her eyes when she told me she's trying to help me, you know, maybe gardening or, you know, because, you know, there's something with your hands. I said, no, I'm going to be an actor, a comedian, an entrepreneur. Like my dad. My dad was a calculator kid. He sold all these millions of calculators in the early 70s. Eventually lost it all. But, you know, I wanted to find something like that that popped and, you know, like a big business. So I started my business a day after high school selling tools like he did in the, you know, before the calculators, and it failed miserably after 2 weeks. I was like, it's summertime. I took some classes at, you know, City College. I took acting and psychology, which I love, and a business. And
I have to ask you, man, like, I get this a lot. Like, sometimes people think they can get into like comedy right away. Like, were you one of those people where people told you you were funny and that gave you confidence to do it? Or did you just internally want to do it yourself and you didn't care about that?
That was the other thing, you know, physical fitness, but before physical fitness, I was always the youngest. I was the entertainer. I was the funny guy. I'd make fun of myself when I had nothing to go for me and make fun of others, you know? So yeah, I would, you know, that was it. By the time I did stand up, it was like, I was meant to be there. I was scared, you know, because you're doing something for the first time, you're on stage and there was about 150 people there.
Wow.
You know, but I already did stand up at City College where I was going and I kind of killed it, you know, and everybody's like, how long have you been doing stand up? I'm like, this is the first time I ever attempted, you know, but I knew that I was doing my whole life. You know, speaking of bodybuilding, Tony Pearson, who's a famous bodybuilder, he went, you know, I invited him. Mm-hmm. And then there was this older guy who was doing stand-up for a while. It was my first time. And he went up after me and Tony's like, bring on the kid, you know, and I didn't even know him that well. I was like, I'm doing okay, you know? So that was like that plus physical fitness really added to my belief that I could do more things if I just put time plus effort.
Okay. Now, I heard comedians get their stuff from like just real life incidences. I don't know. Like when you started, did you like make a list of like, okay, I'm nervous, I'm just gonna do these 5 jokes, and I'm probably like 3 minutes, you know, when you start. So just read off the jokes and hopefully you'll get some laughs. Or was it different?
No, I mean, I grew up watching stand up, and I grew up seeing a lot of stuff because I grew up in a very sexual, like dysfunctional family. You know, because my dad. Long story, we can get in that. But I grew up watching, like, you know, at a young age, Richard Pryor and a lot of progressive comedians. So by the time it was all conversational and I understood that, you know, you would talk about your inadequacies and all that. So I would talk about those things. And I did 24 minutes, which four or 5 minutes was solid, you know, and which is not bad, you know, five minutes is great for, you know, first time, but it was long form, you know, and I could have shaved it, but luckily there was enough laugh points in between the long, you know, stuff. But then what you do is, and I had my list of things I was going to talk about. Mm-hmm. So then shortly after that, I studied with Greg Dean, who's the greatest comedy writer in the history of stand-up. He is, look him up. He's trained some of the greatest comedians and he's worked with some of the greatest comedians ever. And he taught me to make an association list that are contrasting. So you make it, you know, dating plus drugs or dating plus shopping, you know? So now my first girlfriend was a total slut. So I was like, you know, did it in the premise of attaching to another premise. I came up with a joke. I'm like, dating my ex-girlfriend wasn't bad. The only thing that bothered me was waiting that long line, you know, waiting on the long line of shopping, you know. That joke's not funny, by the way, disclaimer, because it's out of context, but the contrast of that plus shopping, dating plus shopping, waiting in lines and checkout. So, you know, you do association lists. And so what good comedians do, and then they do writing groups together. You ever see those comedians hanging outside of the comedy store or a comedy club? They're all tagging each other's jokes. They're helping each other out, or they're at least saying they're envious of the other guy because they want to succeed themselves, but they'll actually say, hey, you know, it would be good for your other joke there. And they would, that's how you write.
Hey, I got a good question. Have you ever wanted to like mentor a younger comedian where, let's say you saw him kind of struggling and he's getting down and you're like, hey man, just keep working hard, keep trying.
Well, yeah, you always do that. And especially in writing group, especially when we were working with Greg Dean or you're just hanging out. I always did that, but you know, I never really formally, other than a couple of people, like just recently, I have a saloon in my property. I live in Texas now and I built a saloon, which has like a stage and it says the Joker's Club. And a pastor in the area said, I wanted to get more jokes in my routine, in my delivery. I said, well, come on over. And I went over the kind of just talking about association lists and all that. And I said, let's talk about your life and comedy sit in the negative. And what, you know, even though you're trying to, you know, talk about positive things, you know, every joke is a premise and a punchline. And in between that premise and punchline is a negative denominator, is a negative subject matter. Like, you know, take my wife, for example, take her, please, you know, so take my wife, please take her. Cause I hate her. So, you know, that's the structure of a joke right there. Every joke is structured like that. So we talked about that, and that was just, but never really formally, but just recently, that was one where I kind of sat down with somebody formally. I'll leave it all that to training to Greg D, my mentor and the best out there for that. And written, he's written like several books and he's awesome.
It's funny. I wonder if there's ever been moments, you know, Louis C.K., right?
Who? Oh, Louis C.K. Yeah. He's a comedian's comedian.
Yeah, it's funny. I watched one episode and he's watching this younger comedian just bomb and bomb and bomb. So he takes him out to coffee and he's like, kid, you're not good, man. Maybe you should do something else or something. And he's like, no, it's my dream. And he's like, oh man, you suck. Okay, fine. Just make a funny voice and maybe that'll work or whatever. So then the next episode, he does a funny voice and he kills it. And he's like, you gotta be kidding me. You gotta be kidding me.
Oh my God. Yeah, no, I love him. Louis C.K. I mean, I know he's gotten into some trouble before, but man, talk about technique.
Oh, I love a series. I think it's just called Louis and everything, but it's hilarious. So you worked at the Acme Club, right? Are you doing comedy there?
I did. Majority of my stand-up's done at a comedy store up in the Belly Room. That was my sweet spot. Greg Dean did showcases there, and I would do stand-up there.
Okay. Now, did that get you into acting, or did that help get your foot in the door in acting?
No, I started acting. I always wanted to be an actor since I saw my friend Bradley Craig on Stand By Me. He had a nice, good part, and I was like, I've been wanting to do acting for a while there. My first acting job was playing Dirt Diggler in The Dirt Diggler Story, which is the short film version of Boogie Nights, which I've been in as well. I was dating Elizabeth Goober, Peter Goober's daughter, and her sister was dating Paul Thomas Anderson.
Okay.
And Paul, at the time, he didn't have a car. He's younger, and crashed his car. So he was 17 and he's like, I need to ride home. I said, I'll ride you home. And I went into my stand-up routine. I was just on a roll, you know, and the more I see that he's laughing, you know how it is. You want to make the juice go through their nose, theoretically. I had him rolling in stitches and I dropped him off. And then 2 days later, he's like, look, he calls me up. He says, I got an idea for a short film about the rise and fall of a porno star, Nick Dirtler, kind of like a Spinal Tap, you know, thing. Okay. And I was like, I'm in, you know, and that was my, we did some other things before that leading up to it, like, you know, joke, you know, kind of, you know, projects. And then that was my first acting gig in that. And then did other things. And then I went on to write and direct and act and other things that I did from there.
And again, you have some experience in acting at this time, right? You did some acting in college, like some classes.
Yeah. I mean, I did classes, but I was never in anything before that. Okay. I was just, you know, doing plays in college as like, you know, work, you know, getting on stage and, you know, putting in reps in front of, you know, a teacher at a city college. This is before I studied with Eric Morris, who's a venerable acting teacher. So I kind of like, you know, just went from like, you know, a couple semesters at city college and some gigs and stand up to boom, here you go. You're going to do some, you know, do a whole thing. And you're going to play the lead in this thing. And even though it was like down and dirty little kids film, it was interesting.
But he saw potential in you. That's the main thing. He saw potential.
He did, you know, and I appreciated that. He and I really clicked, you know. Think about Paul Thomas Anderson. He's got a great sense of humor. You know, I don't think, because he's making such serious films, but his sense of humor is, I just love it.
It's funny. I was recently talking to this chick. I would maybe call her like a B or C list celebrity. She was in that series, Dear White People on Netflix. I don't know if you ever heard of that.
No.
And she's in this new Netflix movie, something about back in the 90s, there was like this war in Africa or whatever. I can't remember. Anyways.
Not out of Africa.
It was like similar to Hotel Rwanda. I don't know if you remember that. But that whole war and everything. Anyways, so she's been like, again, let's say she's been acting or training for like the past 10 years. She's going to summer camps, like scene classes and all this. And again, that's... to me, like being on a Netflix TV show, even for 3 or 4 episodes, pretty damn good. Like still. Right. And I think I insulted her. I don't know. Cause like we just started talking again. I just asked her, hey, you know, is it possible for like a guy like me who's never had any experience can just go on a tryout or, you know, audition and just kill it and get a major role? And she was just like, no, absolutely. Like, and I don't know. I think she was just getting, let's say the butt hurt. Cause it's just like, why not? Like, why can't someone just kill it? And again, okay, fine. At the same time, I understand why she's pissed, because she spent so many years working her butt off and seeing acting classes. It's like an insult to think that I could just walk in.
I like to take a stab at that explanation.
Please.
So you can, there are people out there that have unconscious competence that are just, I mean, everybody has a scale. Like it's like working out with a muscle. Like I was a small kid, but then my muscles took to it really well. So when I started training, right? Yep. Training acting, you could take to it really well. or there's someone like, you just know inherently they have the bones, they have the natural uniqueness inherently. That's where somebody might just suck in the beginning, but then they work their ass off and then they're amazing. I don't know how good Dan Day-Lewis was when he first started, you know, but he's incredible now, like, you know, with so many others, you know. So Jennifer Lawrence, if you look at her, she's a wild animal,
yeah,
you know, and you just know that she studied and she did Winter's Bone, but that was her first major film. But you also know there's an inherent ability of somebody that has gone through it. And here's what it requires of somebody that's in touch with their emotions. Okay. Mm-hmm. That creates a base, because then you have to take the parallel emotions from the written piece and then combine it. So if you've grown up in a family that, you know, has been in touch with their psychology, in touch with their personal inventory of their emotions, mm-hmm. and then you can inherently say, look, I can understand the concept. You could really, now you're going to be better if you train. But that, to say there's absolutes, there's 8 billion people on planet Earth. You're going to mm-hmm. find somebody that has the inherent bones to, you know, do really well in audition. And that's my explanation.
Right. It's like martial arts. Like, I'm a brown belt in jiu-jitsu right now. If somebody, and again, I've been doing jiu-jitsu for like 14 years. If somebody came into the gym and let's say got to the brown belt in like 2 or 3 years, I wouldn't hate on them. I'm like, fine. All right, man, you're good. Good for you. Like,
that's right. You know? I mean, it's such a big world out there. And there's people that you train your ass off. And if you think that the best actors on planet Earth are the ones that we know about, they're not. And the best people that can play baseball, we're not. They're just people that have, you know, gone through the moves.
Again, why is that? Is it just because they're super attractive? They know the right people, right time, right place?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Plus, you know, do they want to? Do they, you know, going through it, time plus effort, choices, you know, happenstance, ability under certain circumstances, you know, supply and demand, need. I mean, the algorithm is endless.
Yeah. Yeah. And I get it, because it is sad, because I heard, like, again, people can, like, let's say the classic scenario, they moved to Los Angeles, they have the strong belief, I'm going to give it my all, and they can go their whole lives without ever making it.
Right. Now, there is an algorithm to make it more probable. I've seen that river flow many times. Like in the case of Paul Thomas Anderson, he knew what he wanted to do. He was 6 years old. He had a project when he was in first grade. It says, I want to be an actor, or I want to be a writer, director, producer, special effects man. I know how to do everything. I can do everything. Now, that's a 6-year-old writing that. That's amazing. You know, and I see people that are young all the time on my podcast, and they're like, that are now older, that knew what they wanted to do. And that was hyper focused. There's something to be said about that. So the probability of success is going to be so much greater with the long-term focus and time plus effort.
Oh, absolutely, man. And I got to ask you another thing too, like the power of success. Do you feel like, yes, part of success is just working your ass off, but do you think you just need some help? You need some luck, let's say, in life.
Again, yes. It's all, yeah, you know, everything helps. You know, you have to work really hard to put yourself in lucky situations. You have to have time plus effort. You have to have, you know, speed, you know, you have to be intuitive. You have to just be hyper-focused, you know, you don't have to, but, and if so, well, this guy wasn't. I was like, yeah. He got lucky, or but he still worked hard to get lucky, or he did X, Y, and Z. Like, you know, I knew about Bitcoin when it was worth $1, you know, I mean, why didn't I just one small paradigm shift in one conversation with somebody might've shifted me over. It's like, all right, I put $100,000 into it. Wouldn't imagine putting $100,000 into it, you know, or just $10,000 into it. And then it, you know, so there's all kinds of choices, and there's so many gray areas we can get into, you know, it's like not a black or white. Right. So yeah. You know, sometimes people are just like, you can go out buy a lottery ticket right now, which, ladies and gentlemen, it's about $750 million, and you can go buy your ticket and win. But you chose to make that choice. Yeah, yeah. So mm-hmm. love that.
Okay. Rather, like, dude, overall, like, what's your favorite film? What was your best favorite film to be in?
That's like saying, which is my favorite child, but I'll go, you know, get that asked a lot. So, you know, On the Waterfront, Rocky, you know, Godfather 1 and 2. I love Pulp Fiction. There Would Be Blood. I'm partial to Boogie Nights because of the, you know, the internal story. Inherent, The Wind, it goes on and on.
Okay. What do you like better, stand-up comedy or acting?
That's a tough question. That's a tough one. I really like, you know, there's something about acting to where you can just, you know, express and get inside and a character is so exciting. But to me, stand-up comedy is like, for me, and even though I'm an entrepreneur now and I have a totally different, I feel like... One day I'll just go back to stand-up comedy. That's all I'm going to do. To me, stand-up comedy the connection of the people and a microphone and just conversation and getting that reward every, you know, 15 to 20 seconds mm-hmm. is ineffable on how good that feels. So I'd say slightly tipping to stand-up comedy.
Yeah. All right. Nice. Nice. I respect that. So then what eventually got you into directing?
I wanted to be an actor. Okay. I was like, okay. No one's going to cast me. Or like, I just felt like I was like, you know, I felt like I wasn't going to be able to catch, which is just, you know, it's weird. There's a game to play there. There's a social game. There's a numbers game. Yeah. You know, they say 30 auditions for one job. I was like, dude, in those days you had to drive there. Yeah. You know, I got to sit on the 405. I got to, you know, that takes time. And I'm like, I also wanted to be an entrepreneur. Remember, I want to be a stand-up comedian, actor, and entrepreneur. I was like, I could be making money because I always wanted to have, I don't want to be one of those actors or stand-up comedians that didn't have a family, you know, that was like, you know, I was like, well, it hasn't happened yet. So I'm just going to keep on going. And this is more important to me. I was like, screw it. I'm going to make money eventually to make my own movie and put myself in there. I just got just so intense. You know, I ended up doing that. I started my business. I was like, well, I did an award-winning short film, wrote, directed, and produced. I acted in it to give myself a small part, but I took myself out. That's how dedicated I was to making a good film, which is called Rituals and Resolutions, which got bought by HBO and did really well. But then I went through like everybody in Hollywood, all the meetings. I went with Joel Silver's office and all these, you know, and I was going to deal with Trimark Pictures to make one of the films that I wrote and get it produced. And I was going to direct, and it just didn't happen. And it was like 3 years of this, you know, from the point that I made my film. So I said, screw it. I'm going to start a business again. Cause I was always an entrepreneur. When I, shortly after I did stand up, that business failed when I started it, when I was like 19 or 18, when I started that business. Shortly after I did stand up, I brought a lot of people in. I said, I'm going to be a nightclub promoter. I become the number one nightclub promoter in Los Angeles. That was my identity for a long time. I was known as that guy. And then I left that to become a filmmaker. And I became totally broke. And I invested everything in filmmaking. And I just like, after, you know, several years, 7 or 8 years of that, and I was broke and in debt, I said, screw it. I'm going to make my own movie. Mm-hmm. I just need to find a way to make money again. So I started the business I did now. It's been like back in 2000, I started selling tarps on the internet. Mm-hmm. But my dad, it was one of my dad's tools, and I blew up like within 6 months. Wow. Like, had enough money to make a movie with, I wrote, directed, produced, and acted in a movie called Love Hollywood Style, which is a crazy film. It was like, fuck you to Hollywood. You know, I was like, you know, I'm going to make this film. No one's going to let me make it. It's about love and dysfunctionality in Hollywood, crazy comedy. And I had got Andy Dick and Coolio and Faye Dunaway. Mm-hmm. And I acted in it. And that was like my swan song. It was my last real film I did. And that did won some awards at film festivals, and it got picked up, you know, it had some distribution. But my business just took off from there.
Yeah.
Made over $100 million, is well over that since. And now I just keep on growing that. But that's like kind of my journey of, you know, the battle of trying to be a filmmaker, trying to, you know, be an actor by my own destiny rather than going auditions. And eventually I went on auditions after that just to see how, I'm like, yeah, I want to see how well I could do the audition thing. I started doing well, but I was like, I'm making more money with my business. And you know, there was not enough leverage there. I said, so that's where I am now. That's where I, you know, I have a business that is constantly growing and doing well. And we have some big plans for that business. I'm launching another business outside of that to create hopefully a product and that will become a name brand that you will know about. Called Bolator, and will hopefully be like the next Yeti. It's going to be big and exciting, and that's coming out in 2023. And that all started with me starting this business to become a filmmaker and pay for movie, you know, and say, hey, maybe if I can make enough, you know. But right now we're in entrepreneur mode.
So I have to ask you, when all of this is going on, when you're acting, directing, what was your relationship like with your family? Were they supportive, your mom and dad? How was that like?
No, like, well, you do what you want to do, you know, but like I was working as a production assistant. So it's like, fine, you want to live paycheck to paycheck, you know, or hope you're going to be okay.
So they didn't support you, you're saying?
No, they didn't have the money. Like my dad made millions, and then he lost it all.
Yeah.
He was in jail. I worked for him for free when I was in high school for like a whole summer. So he never really got his money back. You know, he had a crazy lifestyle. He made millions in the early 70s selling calculators. They call him the calculator kid, you know, and then he had that character in Boogie Nights, Burt Reynolds plays, is loosely based on my dad. Cause like my dad had these famous orgy parties. Yeah. And Paul like loved my dad. And he, you know, so that character of the parties at the house with the artwork on the walls and these are my lady friends and orgy is a crazy stuff. That was my dad. And he just had a crazy lifestyle and lost it all. So we were a poor family that lived in a rich neighborhood. We were like the Encino Jubilees, you know, I grew up around a lot of rich neighborhood, but everybody always had a lot of stuff that I didn't have. Mm-hmm. So by the time it came to be a filmmaker, they didn't have any money to give me. So it was just like borrowing money from friends that did have money. Mm-hmm. And then just working paycheck to paycheck and pulling in favors. And that was it, you know? So they were supportive on like, hey, do what you want to do, but mm-hmm. I didn't have any money as far as support.
Yeah. Now, regarding your dad, I know he went through a lot and everything. Did he teach you anything positive about his success, or did you take anything positive from him when it comes
absolutely.
To
characteristics? Shades of gray, right? I mean, he loved me. He was like, he should have never been a father, you know, because he was like such a, you know, but he was a loving father. He was loving to everybody. He told me tons of things, and seeing him, you know, he was a people person, you know, and he loved people, and women and men loved him. You know, they all loved him so much, and he loved them.
Was it the guys wanted to be him and the women wanted to be with him type thing?
Yeah. And he was strikingly good looking. If you see this right here, this guy up here, right there, that's my dad. I think I'm pointing to it. The good looking guy, the little kid, that's my older brother. He looked like Elvis. He was very charming. You know, I'd be like walking in Westwood when I was a kid. He'd be wearing all black with black sunglasses. And two girls in their 20s go up to him and say, excuse me, sir, can I ask you a question? He goes, yeah. He said, yeah. They're like, who are you? And he takes off his glasses and he has these good looking eyes. And he's like, hey, I'm just me. And they walk away and they're like, they mouth, my God, you know, they both look at each other and go, God. And I was like, wow, I want to be that guy.
Yep.
And I knew it wasn't a fluke because when he got out of jail, he was broke. He was driving me to my girlfriend's house at the time. And we're on the way over there. This is like, this is so great. We're on the way over there. Oh, this segues into the therapist story. Because you're a therapist. So we're on the way over to, you know, this is when I'm last year of high school, on the way to my girlfriend's house. These two African-American women in a Rolls Royce look over at my dad and they're flirting with him and the other, he's in the passenger car and he rolls down the window. Right. And then he's like, he takes off those glasses again and goes, hello. And they're like, woo, you know, and all that. And I was like, oh my God, and where does this happen? So then I go to my girlfriend's house and my girlfriend's in the house, but the mother and the older sister answer the door.
Yep.
My dad walks in front of me and again, takes his glasses off to go inside wearing all black. And he goes, hi, I'm Mike's dad. And they're like, come in. And he walks in front of them and they look at each other. And what do they do?
Yep.
My God. You know, so I grew up idolizing this guy. So he was a loving dad, but I learned a lot from him in graciousness, you know, modesty, because he was never braggadocious and he had a lot to brag about. He had a lot to, you know, had humbleness. He was a street kid. So he was used to sleeping in a van after he got out of jail, you know, for 6 months till he bounced back with his tool business. Have you ever heard of the company called Harbor Freight? That was his Alan Smith, who started a multi-billion-dollar company called Harbor Freight.
Okay.
It was like the Home Depot-esque, you know, kind of company, publicly traded. That was his business partner in the 60s. And then Alan Smith went on to create Harbor Freight, as my dad sold these calculators by the time my dad came back to sell tools again after his crazy lifestyle. Mm-hmm. You know, he was just like a jobber again. He was just like, you know, broken as to where his old partner was now making millions. So I learned about rich man, poor man, the slow path, the steady path. Don't have orgies and be crazy, you know, and chip away day to day. But I did. There was the good traits of my dad. So this leads into my therapist story. Would you like to hear it?
Absolutely.
Okay. So just got over a breakup with my fiance. I'm an older guy now. I'm like in my early 30s. And my dad comes in from San Francisco and says, hey, son, how you doing? And I said, hey, I'm going to a therapist session right now. I'm going to be busy for about an hour. Do you want to go? He goes, yeah, sure. I'll do it. You know, he's a people pleaser.
Goes with the flow.
Right. So then we drive over there and I said, hi, you know, this is the little home in Encino that the therapist at, you know, she works at her house. Nice place. So I said, is it okay if my dad sits on the session? You're right. So it's like, yeah, sure. You know? Yep. So he walks in and he starts complimenting her on her artwork on the walls and just charming her. And it's not placating. It's just in his nature. Yeah. Right. And he's enjoying the conversation and she's enjoying the conversation. He's kind of heavy set, but he's still a really attractive guy. Kind of like Elvis was heavy set.
Okay. And this is your time, right? Your therapy time. And you're just like,
this is the best therapy time. Because I've seen this happen so many times, but watching him do it with a therapist was like such a treat, you know, charming. And it was fun, you know? So then he starts charming her and he's like, well, let's get into it. Then I start sharing, which is weird because I'm sharing in front of my dad, but I was always the entertainer in me trying to seek the higher meaning of, you know, cerebralness, you know, exercising that in front of my dad was a learning experience, you know, because I was also heavily involved in personal development this time since like my mid 20s. He just builds this to a crescendo of a rapport with her, this bandaloop of a crescendo. And then as they're laughing, he goes, can I ask you a question? Do you like music? At her zenith of like, you know, at this point when she's like totally, she's like grabbing her heart. She goes, I love music. And he goes, I'll be right back. And he grabs this Ghetto Blaster from his car that has a CD of Dean Martin singing in Italian. And my dad had an amazing singing voice. He always wanted to be a singer. And he starts singing her in her house, this Dean Martin song in Italian. Wow. And she sits there right in the middle of it. And he's looking at her eyes. And I think he maybe tapped her leg at one side. And she goes, oh my God, I'm in love. And she's grabbing her heart again with the same like, oh my God. And I'm like, yep, there it is. It's there like, having, you know, and then she's like, and he's sitting there and he's done and they're talking. And it's like this big crescendo of like, of a rapport and everything. And he's like, at the end of it, she goes, oh my God, this is like, where time is up. Or I would love to do this again. He looks at her and he just taps on her leg, not creepy, like just like, you know, a subtle touch. And he looks at her and like with that gaze, those eyes, and he says, we should do this again sometime. And she goes, I would love that.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And then that was it. You know, I went back next week and I was like, it was like half of it, you know, I was like, you know, he had such a traumatic lifestyle. And I tried to talk about that because he was put in an orphanage when he was 8 years old and he still has parents and he ran away and he slept in an alleyway at Lower East Side in New York. And he was, you know, just a street kid and he was abused and all that. And he's been shot at, but, you know, all kinds of volatility and a crazy lifestyle. But which I know it sounds crazy, but I asked her, and from a therapist standpoint, I said, you know, we didn't get into the deep on that. And he goes, you know, I don't think he needs therapy because he's learned to mask it. Cause he's one of the happiest people I ever met in my life.
Yeah.
I don't think he needs to mask that. It's okay that he's masked because this guy is in bliss. So why dig it up? He's actually found a way to be happy. And my dad was actually one of the happiest people I ever met in my life.
And the therapist actually said that.
That was her opinion. It was her opinion. It's like, there's no really need for him to dig it up. Cause I said, we really didn't dig up the dirt on what all that pain that probably could have been there. He goes, but obviously he's over that pain. He goes, how? And she tasked me, like, has your dad, you know, does he have dark thoughts? You know, I was like, he had anger issues, you know, once in a blue moon, like once every year, you know, like I was never around him enough to, you know, exercise that. Cause he was absentee father somewhat off and on. We spent more time as an adult, but he's just the happiest person. So sometimes it was her opinion as that therapist said, don't dig up those pains.
Yeah, and I guess one way you could look at it too is like compensation, like where it could be compensating like those feelings in other areas,
right?
Too, because again, I don't know how your mom felt about that behavior. Like when they were, are they still married or again?
No. Finally, after 25 years, they broke up and they finally divorced. And he actually wanted it to happen for her because he was like he knew that he, you know, he couldn't. And they loved each other. It was her first love, and he became like, you know, he wanted to be friends with my stepdad, who's a sergeant in the Marine Corps. He came around when I was 10. Everybody got along, which is crazy. You know, like we'd all have, you know, my dad got along with everybody, you know, so it was hard for them not to get along. And so it was all, you know, and it all worked out, you know, but yeah, he did get married at the end, but it was a really, the lady wanted to control him and it wasn't such a healthy relationship for him. And it was a weird ending, but we won't get into it.
No, just regarding like separation and divorces, man, I'll give it to them. It's so good to have like a clean one where it doesn't cause drama with the kids and everything. That's the worst, man.
That was weird. I've always seen like people say, I've been friends with my ex-girlfriend's boyfriends in the past because I'm like, that guy's a cool guy. I'm friends with him. And it's like, how could you do that? I was like, I don't know. I grew up watching my dad being friends with my stepdad. Not like they hung out, but my dad, you know, became friends with his son and took care of him sometimes. And I just saw the mixing and matching of like, if you were nice, then just you're a decent person, then why not socialize with each other?
Why not? You know, that so reminds me of that movie called The Breakup. I think it was with Jennifer Aniston and Vince Vaughn.
Right.
That one scene where he's like playing football. I just saw this last night, actually, or 2 nights ago, whatever. He's like playing football with like the date and everything. And then the date leaves and he's just talking about how great Vince Vaughn is. And she's like, I can't do this. I'm done. I can't.
Yeah. That's a good movie. I like that movie. I love anything Vince Vaughn does. He just tickles me.
Oh, God, yeah. So is there any other aspects of like psychology that you are really interested in? Because I know you took it in college. And do you see a lot of that like in actors and stand-up comedians and et cetera?
Yeah, well, as far as, you know, psychology, my love is personal development. Done everything that Tony Robbins has done, Wayne Dyer, Zig Ziglar. So I, you know, really got heavily involved in that. It's been a push and pull. And then, you know, since I was 22, I've always been involved in psychology when I was in college, even since I was 18. But then I got heavily involved in personal development and really involved in it. When I became successful is when I said, now I have enough money, I'm just going to just I went to Fiji, you know, and I actually helped Tony Robbins, you know, on his leadership program and all that.
Nice.
And that personal development and 60 minute psychology and levels of consciousness, and that really hits a sweet spot. So how does that play into stand-up comedy and acting? I think you say you want to be an actor, better actor or business person or stand-up comedian. I always say, my daughters who want to do some of those things, say, look, study personal development. You know, why do people do what they do? Why do what you do? And understand that, you know, I really wish you can't get involved in that early enough to understand those things. And then it's so weird that they don't teach it in school on a more prevalent level, you know, because the consciousness level, we don't talk about consciousness level, you know, there's the levels, the seven levels of consciousness, you know, and we won't get into them right now. But I'm sure you know about it. And everybody can't listen. You can look it up, you know, or 6 Human Needs psychology. Why people do what they do. We don't study that. And I think that it helps you as an artist, helps you as a person, helps you in relationships. You know, it's so weird. You know, after I finally failed when I was going to that therapist, I failed that. I felt like, you know, my fiance at the time, she was a habitual pot smoker who cheated on me with a guy named Bud. What are the odds of that?
Oh, man.
I said, look, rather than blaming it all on her, why not figure out what you're doing wrong? So I went heavily in John Gray, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, and, you know, Venus and Mars in the Bedroom and all that. And that really helped. You know, you try to figure out a manual of like what can help you. So that helps you with artists. I'm just heavily on that. I feel like if you don't, you should study something that really dominates your life. So being a father, being in a relationship, if you're going to get a written piece for a script and you need to act in it, you should know what the fuck you're supposed to feel, think, and ask yourself the who, what, where, why, when, and how, and five times of that, like Toyota does with why is this when they're trying to figure out problems in their business. You should do that with your passions and your life, or if you want to be successful.
Well, and I think it's like how it's taught to you too is very important. Like you could take one class and a person teaches like psychology in one particular way and it's absolutely horrible. And someone else takes the same class with another teacher and it's a completely different experience. And I say that because believe it or not, I absolutely dreaded, even though I'm a therapist, I dreaded undergrad psychology. It was the worst thing ever. I couldn't stand it. I wanted to leave class early every day. I couldn't take it. It was so bad.
Yeah. And I think you can have a bifurcation of two different types of, you know, methodologies of psychology, you know, because there's different, you know, types of belief systems, you know, as long as, you know, it meets the school's criteria and you don't infringe on, you know, certain aspects. So, you know, I think that there's not enough.
I think it was more just the way it was taught. She was nice and everything, but she was just very like dull and slow, like when her speaking voice and everything, where I like professors or teachers who are excited and yelling and screaming and getting around. Like there's this teacher in high school that I still remember teaching like history and ancient Civ War. I loved coming to his class every single day just because of the way he taught and his excitement. It was just amazing.
Right. Because it's also the triad of emotions, right? There's a physiology focus and your vocabulary. So if somebody is on a certain, you know, it's a recipe, right? For how you're going to feel. So if you want somebody to get excited, you know, there's been studies to where you can look at somebody laughing in a video and inherently you're going to have by just the visualization. So you're focusing on that. Then if your dialogue changes, that's congruent with that emotion. This is acting too, ladies and gentlemen, to where if you want to, you know, you have a recipe towards the emotions that the character needs to have in that piece, then your vocabulary, your physiology, there's a recipe towards that emotion and, you know, sense memory, and then also your words. So that's going to, the triad of emotions, words, focus, physiology. And if your teacher was teaching you and he was congruent with you feeling energetic and those passionate words are coming out, and his physiology, his breathing deep, he's looking up and he's not slumped over, you know, you're going to feel that, you know, as well. And it's going to rub off.
It's mirroring their behavior and it's awesome. Yeah. So getting back to the career aspect, I know we mentioned a lot of different types of like personalities and traits of success and whatnot. And now you're into podcasting, right? Now, how long have you been a podcaster, if you don't mind me asking?
About a year and a half.
Okay. A year for me. So
yeah.
Has podcasting been a lot different than any of your other business adventures, particular ways? Or
Yeah. So when I was a nightclub promoter, I would get to get a data set of meeting people on micro levels, you know, for maybe, you know, sometimes 15 seconds, sometimes 20 minutes. So you're shaking hands, you're running for president without an education, and you get a data set of all these people in the world, and you're getting, you know, an algorithm of, you know, certain things. And then stand-up comedy, and then all that has to do. But with podcasting, get to sit down and say, look, I'm going to cherry pick, you know, people that excel at certain things. Then I'm going to ask questions. And my methodology of interviewing somebody is try to interview them like their life is a screenplay. This is inherently how I always met somebody. So I will then ask them, I'm like, well, how does this fit in a story? But I'll ask them the origin of life. And then I will get to inciting incidences, their ghost, their emotional need at, you know, before they had a new equilibrium to find their success. And I'll go through the story structure. Mm-hmm. One is because it's more entertaining for me. But two, then it helps me learn, you know, about how they achieved their success. By the time I'm done with that process, I'm like, holy shit. I'm like, you know, Terminator when he gets dumped down in the molten lava and all the bodies start coming out, you know, of him. I feel like I got a part of that person inside me now. Yeah. And it's been exponential, rapid, super fast speed growth that I've never really experienced before. You know, we do 3 episodes a week, and every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday is when I'll do, especially Fridays, I'll do like immersion. I'll be interviewing sometimes 4 people, 5 people in a day, and I'll be able to immerse myself in all those lessons. And I'm in doing it in real time, because now if they have something unique that aided their success, I get to ask them in real time. I'm like, how did that, it was executed? Oh my God, it's freaking amazing.
Well, you learn so much from people. And my favorite part is it's like you're hearing their life journey. And I feel like when they talk about it, I'm there with them in their journey. And I just feel like that's so cool.
Yeah. I mean, there's certain people want to find out more about space, and that's cool. But I mean, finding out how, like, on the flip side, like, this is difficult for me because, like, I like talking about and sharing. But also, like right now, I'm looking at your head and I'm like, I want to know what's inside, you know, Jacob. Like, where was he born? How, what did he do? What did his parents do for a living? What made him? Why did he go into therapy? You know, what's his weirdest thing that's ever happened in therapy? You know, what is he most proud of? I mean, it goes on and on.
Oh, it's a beautiful thing too. And I'm really interested in also, again, the business aspect too, because the most important thing they tell me, because again, I'm a nerd. I've listened to so many podcasts about podcasting or YouTube videos on podcasting. It's like, never going in for the money. Don't care about like the downloads, which, okay, fine. I get, I mean, my main priority is getting my word out, learning about people. But I'm not going to lie. Like, I put in a lot of work and effort. I would like some downloads. I would like a good amount of downloads and maybe someday make some money, you know?
Right. Yeah. I like to share while, you know, cause I would, you know, I would love, you build something, you want it to be as best as it can be. You know, you don't want to say, no, I want to be the, you know, or I don't really care. Yeah. I mean, if you had a choice, if it's on the table, I like to have the numbers that, you know, Joe Rogan has, but you go for it. But reason why I do it, I wasn't going for it to, it wasn't my main driver. My main driver is to, for connection to, cause it really makes me, you know, enjoy life. I'm like, you know, look at what we're doing here, you know, to get connection with people. And then also, I'm also, the secondary is I'm building another podcast, you know, that's going to be for our brand that there's this other company. So I've like an outdoor survival, hunting, fishing, camping,
nice,
you know, survivalist that is going to bifurcate into another podcast. I'm still do this one, Love Longshot Leaders, but it's going to go off into that once a week. So I feel like, okay, that substantiates the monetary spend that I'm doing right now with this podcast, because Longshot Leaders, I don't monetize it. It's a passion, you know? And it's like, well, where am I substantiating this? I'm like, well, the other podcast that'll help segue into, you know, that will aid, you know, a business. So I can substantiate that way.
Dude, this has just been awesome, man. I greatly appreciate it. And, but okay. All right. So before we kind of close, I got to ask you one thing, man. What happened with your dad and the therapist? I'm sorry, man. I just got to ask professionally.
He never pursued it. He was living up in San Francisco. You know, he was driving down to LA. So he went back up to San Francisco to his group of friends at the time before he met his next wife up there. And then he met a lady and he's gone now. So my mom's gone. The stepdad, you know, they're all gone now. But he, you know, never hooked up with her. But I'm sure it made an impact in both their lives.
Oh, just the picture you painted, like he had her in the palm of his hand.
He did. I'm sure if he pursued it, they would. And then I wish actually he did hook up with her instead of the, you know, he met this wild lady, you know, but that's probably the way his life ended. It might not have been the best scenario for him, you know, but it's kind of like a poetic in the grand scheme of things. You try to look at the silver lining and, you know, but he had a crazy lifestyle. He lived a lot of love, a lot of craziness. And I don't think I'd change anything. You know, this is when you have tough times like that, he didn't end up with the therapist. You know, you try to look at it like, you know, here's a therapist. Here's a good personal development saying, no matter, and I'll end with this. This would be a nice day, Noma. when life is really tough for you, or God forbid, something, your worst fears happen, you know, one day we all have to sit on a table if we're lucky enough to say, well, this is it. This is, we're coming to a close. It might serve you best. And I think it'll serve me best if you get curious, if you get, ask yourself, what can I learn from this? Well, I don't want to end my life, or I don't want to go, you know, I don't want this to happen. What can I learn from this? What is good about this? Well, nothing's good about it. What if there was something good about it? You know, what am I curious about? Or what can I enjoy here, even though it's not enjoyable? Mm-hmm. Those are at least more empowering questions that might lead to a better answer as opposed to this sucks, you know? So that's my parting statement, I guess.
Definitely a better outlook. Hell yeah. Well, man, this has been so special and awesome. And if my listeners do want to make contact with you, is there a particular number, email address they could use to send you a message or whatnot?
Yeah, just go to longshotleaders.com. That's my website for my podcast. And if you have a long shot story, it doesn't have to be someone that's made $1 billion. It's just like, if you have to, like, anybody from, like, I was just an example. I had somebody that was homeless since they were 12 to 24, and then they became like a manager at a company, and then they bought their first house in Idaho, or somebody that started from scratch and then ended up becoming a billionaire. It doesn't have to be, it just, any kind of long shot story, surfing for that ultimate one. So you can go to longshotleaders.com. That's how you could find out more about the podcast.
Well, that's awesome, man. And to all my listeners, I'll put those links on my show notes too for you to have. And yeah, thank you, man. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
I again want to thank Michael and all my PHI listeners for another awesome and amazing episode. I again want to inform everyone that the information expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issue, please seek the care of a licensed medical doctor and a licensed professional counselor. All right, everyone, thank you and have a good day. Bye.